All right. So I was, as far as I know, we are on page 149, and I signed paragraph 16, if I counted them correctly. The Ascent of the Sacrifice 1, chapter 5, the works of knowledge, the psychic being. So there's a section beginning with three stars there, huh? On paragraph 16, page heart. On my edition 149.
Looks right to me.
Yeah?
Okay. If knowledge is the widest power.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I see clockwise today John Robert, me, Andrea, and Jeffrey.
So are you ready for Bell?
Little Mehdi? Yeah.
You just muted yourself, Jeffrey.
Yeah, but I already rang the bell. All right, do it again.
If knowledge is the widest power of the consciousness, and its function is to free and illumine, yet love is the deepest and most intense, and its privilege is to be the key to the most profound and secret recesses of the divine mystery. Man, because he is a mental being, is prone to give the highest importance to the thinking mind and its reason and will, into its way of approach and effectuation of truth. And even he is inclined to hold that there is no other. The heart, with its emotions and incalculable movements, is to the eye of his intellect an obscure, uncertain, and often a perilous and misleading power, which needs to be kept in control by the reason and the mental will and intelligence. And yet there is in the heart, or behind it, a profounder mystic light, which, if not what we call intuition, for that, though not of the mind, yet descends through the mind, has yet a direct touch upon truth, and is nearer to the divine than the human intellect in its pride of knowledge. According to the ancient teaching, the seat of the immanent divine, the hidden Purusha, is in the mystic heart, the secret heart cave, Hridaye Guhyam, as the Upanishads put it. And according to the experience of many yogins, it is from its depths that there comes the voice or the breath of the inner oracle.
This ambiguity, these opposing appearances of death and blindness, are created by the double character of the human emotive being. For there is in front in man a heart of vital emotion, similar to the animals, if more variously developed. Its emotions are governed by egoistic passion, blind instinctive affections, and all the play of life impulses, with their imperfections, perversions, often sordid degradations. A heart besieged and given over to the lusts, desires, wrath, intense or fierce demands, or little greeds and mean pettiness of an obscure and fallen life force, and debased by its slavery to any and every impulse. This mixture of the emotive heart and the sensational hungering vital creates in man a false soul of desire. It is this that is the crude and dangerous element which the reason rightly distrusts and feels and needs to control. Even though the actual control, or rather coercion, it succeeds in establishing over our raw and insentient vital nature, remains always very uncertain and deceptive. But the true soul of man is not there. It is in the true invisible heart, hidden in some luminous cave of the nature. There, under some infiltration of the divine light, is our soul, a silent inmost being of which few are even aware. For if all have a soul, for if all have a soul, few are conscious of their true soul or feel its direct impulse. There dwells the little spark of the divine, which supports the obscure mass of our nature, and around it grows the psychic being, the formed soul, or the real man within us. Man with capital letter. It is at this psychic being in him grows, and the movements of the heart reflect its divinations and impulsions, that man becomes more and more aware of this, of his soul, chooses to be a superior animal, and awaking to glimpse of the Godhead within him, admits more and more its intimations of a deeper life and consciousness and an impulse towards things divine. It is one of the decisive moments of the integral yoga when the psychic being, liberated, brought out from the veil to the front, can pour the full flood of its divinations, seeings, and impulsions on the mind, life, and body of man, and begins to prepare the upbuilding of divinity in the earthly nature.
As in the works of knowledge, so in dealing with the workings of the heart, we are obliged to make a preliminary distinction between two categories of movements. Those that are either moved by the true soul or aid towards its liberation and rule in the nature, and those that are turned to the satisfaction of the unpurified vital nature. But the distinctions ordinarily laid down in this sense are of little use for the deep or spiritual purpose of yoga. Thus, a division can be made between religious emotions and mundane feelings, and it can be laid down as a rule of spiritual life that the religious emotions alone should be cultivated, and all worldly feelings and passions must be rejected and fall away from our existence. This, in practice, would mean the religious life of the saint or devotee, alone with the divine, or linked only to others in a common God love, or, at the most, pouring out the fountains of a sacred, religious, or pietistic love on the world outside. But religious emotion itself is too constantly invaded by the turmoil and obscurity of the vital movements, and it is often either crude or narrow or fanatical or mixed with movements that are not signs of the spirit's perfection. It is evident, besides, that even at the best, an intense figure of sainthood, clamped in rigid hieratic lines, is quite other than the wide ideal of an integral yoga. A larger psychic and emotional relation with God and the world, more deep and plastic in its essence, more wide and embracing in its movements, more capable of taking up in its sweep the whole of life, is imperative.
A wider formula has been provided by the secular mind of man, of which the basis is the ethical sense. For it distinguishes between the emotions sanctioned by the ethical sense and those that are egoistic and selfishly common and mundane. It is the works of altruism, philanthropy, compassion, benevolence, humanitarianism, service, labor for the well-being of man and all creatures that are to be our ideal. To shuffle off the coil of egoism and grow into a soul of self-abnegation that lives only or mainly for others or for humanity as a whole is the way of man's inner evolution according to this doctrine. Or if this is too secular and mental to satisfy the whole of our being, since there is a deeper religious and spiritual note there that is left out of the account by the humanitarian formula, a religious ethical foundation can be provided for it, and such was indeed its original basis. For the inner worship of the divine or the supreme by the devotion of the heart, or to the pursuit of the ineffable by the seeking of a highest knowledge, can be added a worship through altruistic works, or a preparation through acts of love, of benevolence, of service to mankind, or to those around us. It is indeed by the religio-ethical sense that the law of universal goodwill, or universal compassion, or of love and service to the neighbor, the Vedantic, the Buddhistic, the Christian ideal, was created. Only by a sort of secular refrigeration, extinguishing the fervor of the religious element in it, could the humanitarian ideal disengage itself and become the highest plane of a secular system of mental and moral ethics. For in the religious system, This law of works is a means that ceases when its object is accomplished or a side issue. It is part of the cult by which one adores and seeks the divinity, or it is a penultimate step of the excision of self in the passage to nirvana. In the secular ideal, it is promoted into an object in itself. It becomes a sign of the moral perfection of the human being, or else it is a condition for a happier state of man upon earth, a better society, a more unified, a more united life of the race. But none of these things satisfy the demand of the soul that is placed before us by the integral yoga.
Altruism, philanthropy, humanitarianism, service are flowers of the mental consciousness and are at best the mind's cold and pale imitation of the spiritual flame of universal divine love. Not truly liberative from ego sense, they widen it at most and give it a higher and larger satisfaction. Impotent in practice to change man's vital life and nature, they only modify and palliate its action and daub over its unchanged egotistic essence. Or if they are intensely followed with an entire sincerity of the will, it is by an exaggerated amplification of one side of our nature. In that exaggeration, there can be no clue for the full and perfect divine evolution of the many sides of our individualized being towards the universal and transcendent eternal. Nor can the religio-ethical ideal be a sufficient guide, for this is a compromise or compact of mutual concessions for mutual support between a religious urge, which seeks to get a closer hold on earth by taking into itself the higher terms of ordinary human nature, and an ethical urge, which hopes to elevate itself out of its own mental hardness and dryness by some touch of a religious fervor. In making this compact, religion lowers itself to the mental level and inherits the inherent imperfections of mind and its inability to convert and transform life. The mind is the sphere of the dualities, and just as it is impossible for it to achieve any absolute truth, but only truths relative or mixed with error, so is it impossible for it to achieve any absolute good. For moral good exists as a counterpart and corrective to evil, and has evil always for its shadow, complement, almost its reason for existence. But the spiritual consciousness belongs to a higher than the mental plane, and there the dualities cease. For there, falsehood, confronted with the truth by which it profited through a usurping falsification of it, and evil, faced by the good of which it was a perversion or a lurid substitute, are obliged to perish for want of sustenance and to cease. The integral yoga, refusing to rely upon the fragile stuff of mental and moral ideals, puts its whole emphasis in this field on three central dynamic processes. The development of the true soul or psychic being to take the place of the false soul of desire. The sublimation of human into divine love. The elevation of consciousness from its mental to its spiritual and supramental plane, by whose powers alone both the soul and the life force can be utterly delivered from the veils and prevarications of the ignorance.
It is the very nature of the soul or the psychic being to turn towards the divine truths as a sunflower to the sun. It accepts and clings to all that is divine or progressing towards divinity, and draws back from all that is perversion or denial of it, from all that is false and undivine. Yet the soul is at first but a spark and then a little flame of Godhead burning in the midst of a great darkness. For the most part, it is veiled in its inner sanctum, and to reveal itself, it has to call on the mind, the life force, and the physical consciousness, and persuade them as best they can to express it. Ordinarily, it succeeds at most in suffusing their outwardness with its inner light and modifying with its purifying fineness the dark obscurity or the coarser mixture. Even when there is a form psychic being able to express itself with some directness in life, it is still in all but a few smaller portion of the being. No bigger in the mass of the body than the thumb of a man, was the image used by the ancient seers. And it is not always able to prevail against the obscurity or ignorant smallness of the physical consciousness, the mistaken sureness of the mind, or the arrogance and vehemence of the vital nature. This soul is obliged to accept the human mental, emotive, sensational life as it is, its relations, its activities, its cherished forms and figures. It has to labor to disengage and increase the divine element in all these relative truths mixed with a continual falsifying error. This love turned to the use of the animal body or the satisfaction of the vital ego. This life of an average manhood shot with rare and pale glimpses of Godhead and the darker luridities of the demon and the brute. Unerring in the essence of its will, it is obliged often under the pressure of its instruments to submit to mistakes of action, wrong placement of feeling, wrong choice of person, errors in the exact form of its will, in the circumstances of its expression of the infallible inner ideal. Yet is there a divination within it which makes it a surer guide than the reason, or than even the highest desire, and through apparent errors and stumblings, its voice can still lead better than the precise intellect and the considering mental judgment. This voice of the soul is not what we call conscience, for that is only a mental and often conventional erring substitute. It is a deeper and more seldom heard call, yet to follow it when heard is wisest, It is a deeper and more seldom heard call, yet to follow it when heard is wisest. Even it is better to wander at the call of the one's soul than to go apparently straight with the reason and the outward moral mentor. But it is only when the life turns towards the divine that the soul can truly come forward and impose its power on the outer members. For itself, a spark of the divine, to grow inflamed towards the divine, is its true life and its very reason of existence.
At a certain stage in the yoga, when the mind is sufficiently quieted and no longer supports itself at every step on the sufficiency of its mental certitudes, when the vital has been steadied and subdued and is no longer constantly insistent on its own rash will, demand, and desire, and the physical has been sufficiently altered not to bury altogether the inner flame under the mass of its outwardness, obscurity, or inertia. An inmost being hidden within and felt only in its rare influences is able to come forward and illumine the rest and take up the lead of the sadhana. Its character is a one-pointed orientation towards the divine, or the highest, one-pointed, and yet plastic in action and movement. It does not create a rigidity of direction like the one-pointed intellect, or a bigotry of the regnant idea or impulse like the one-pointed vital force. It is at every moment and with a supple sureness that it points the way to the truth, automatically distinguishes the right step from the false, extricates the divine or Godward movement from the clinging mixture of the undivine. Its action is like a searchlight showing up all that has to be changed in the nature. It has in it a flame of will insistent on perfection, on an alchemic transmutation of all the inner and outer existence. It sees the divine essence everywhere, but rejects the mere mask and the disguising figure. It insists on truth, on will and strength and mastery, on joy and love and beauty, but on a truth of abiding knowledge that surpasses the mere practical momentary truth of the ignorance, on an inward joy and not on mere vital pleasure. For it prefers rather a purifying suffering and sorrow to degrading satisfactions. On love winged upward and not tied to the stake of egoistic craving or with its feet sunk in the mire. On beauty restored to its priesthood of interpretation of the eternal. On strength and will and mastery as instruments not of the ego but of the spirit. Its will is for the divinization of life, the expression through it of a higher truth, its dedication to the divine and the eternal.
The most intimate character of the psychic is its pressure towards the divine through a sacred love, joy, and oneness. It is a divine love that it seeks most. It is the love of the divine that is its spur, its goal, its star of truth shining over the luminous cave of the nascent or the still obscure cradle of the newborn Godhead within us. In the first long stage of its growth and immature existence, it has learned of earthly love, affection, tenderness, goodwill, compassion, benevolence, on all beauty and gentleness and fineness and light and strength and courage, on all that can help to refine and purify the grossness and commonness of human nature. But it knows how mixed are these human movements at their best, and at their worst how fallen and stamped with the mark of ego and self-deceptive sentimental falsehood, and the lower self profiting by the imitation of a soul movement. At once emerging, it is ready and eager to break all the old ties and imperfect emotional activities and replace them by a greater spiritual truth of love and oneness. It may still admit the human forms and movements, but on condition that they are turned towards the one alone. It accepts only the ties that are helpful, the hearts and minds' reverence for the guru, the union of the God-seekers, a spiritual compassion for this ignorant, human, and animal world and its peoples, the joy and happiness and satisfaction of beauty that comes from the perception of the divine everywhere. It plunges the nature inward towards its meaning with the imminent divine in the heart's secret center. And while that call is there, no reproach of egoism, no mere outward summons of altruism or duty or philanthropy or service will deceive or divert it from its sacred longing and its obedience to the attraction of the divinity within it. It lifts the being towards a transcendent ecstasy and is ready to shed all the downward pull of the world from its wings in its uprising to reach the one highest. But it calls down also this transcendent love and beatitude to deliver and transform this world of hatred and strife and division and darkness and jarring ignorance. It opens to a universal divine love, a vast compassion, an intense and immense will for the good of all, for the embrace of the world mother enveloping or gathering to her children, the divine passion that has plunged into the night for the redemption of the world from the universal inconscience. It is not attracted or misled by mental imitations or any vital misuse of these deep-seated truths of existence. It exposes them with its detecting search ray and calls down the entire truth of divine love to heal those malformations, to deliver mental, vital, physical love from their insufficiencies or their perversions, and reveal to them their true abounding share of the intimacy and the oneness, the ascending ecstasy, and the descending rapture.
All true truth of love and of the works of love, the psychic being accepts in their place. But its flame mounts always upward, and it is eager to push the ascent from lesser to higher degrees of truth, since it knows that only by the ascent to a highest truth and the descent of that highest truth can love be delivered from the cross and placed upon the throne. For the cross is the sign of the divine descent barred and marred by the transversal line of a cosmic deformation, which turns it into a stake of suffering and misfortune. Only by the ascent to the original truth can the deformation be healed, and all the works of love, as too all the works of knowledge and of life, be restored to a divine significance and become part of an integral spiritual experience. End of the chapter.
So some question, comments, Andrea? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I know I'm just really struck by his description of the cross. For the cross is a sign of the divine descent, barred and marred by the transversal line of a cosmic deformation which turns life into a state of suffering and misfortune. I mean, that is, Christianity is entirely based on the suffering of Christ, right? And that we are guilty of it, and it is such a falsehood in my perception.
I don't see this as incommensurate with Christianity, what he says, though. Really is very close to the Christian understanding of the cross. I don't see it as fundamentally different. It's just another interpretation in a different way, in a different context. I think it's interesting the way he reuses it and redirects it, but I don't think it's incompatible with Christian understanding. I mean, essentially, being crucified on a cross is a kind of deformation, cosmic deformation, as he describes it. So, and the reconnection with the divine in Christianity with the resurrection is the vertical manifesting. So for me, this is simply rephrasing the Christian, but in the context of integral yoga.
Yeah.
What I'm struggling a bit is with this downplaying of philanthropy goodwill, compassion, benevolence, and all beauty and gentleness and fineness and so, which are stamped with the mark of ego and self-deceptive sentimental falsehood. Well, yeah, it might be in many cases, but I don't know if it's always the case. That if I have compassion and do acts of benevolence, yeah, maybe deep down there is the ego, maybe. But I think it's not necessarily so. Perhaps he doesn't mean it in this sense. He says it can be affected eventually. I'm just wondering how one should interpret this. Because we live in a world that I think there are a lot of people who have much, much more than many other people. There are rich people who are becoming richer and richer, and poor people who become poorer and poorer. It would be nice to have a bit more philanthropy in this world. So
I kind of saw it as though he makes an argument first against the ascetics, right? The people who not exactly against them. He kind of says, well, you could go this way. Where you're totally devoted to the God and you're not paying any attention to anything else. But that's not the way of integral yoga.
Yeah.
And then this is the second argument, that you could go the other way and be totally devoted to humanity. And just paying attention to humanity and not paying attention to the divine in its other dimensions.
Yeah.
And that is also a false route for the integral yoga. Not necessarily a route that you couldn't take and still do, but that if you want to follow the integral yoga path, that's not the way to go. That's the way I understood that argument.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right.
That it's not quite enough, that you can do that, but you also need to cultivate this connection with the divine within you and in everyone, that should not be neglected. And of course, if you do a lot of good works, it's easy to kind of overlook your shadows. The ego likes all that beauty and generosity, and there may be a bit of unconscious behind it.
Yeah, and he does say that somewhere. He says the sort of shadows will chase you. Not quite what he says, but he says they'll come back and they'll perturb you from this way of doing things. So he's sort of saying that, like it or not, you can't really avoid the other stuff, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Another way of putting it.
Yeah, sorry.
Go ahead.
No, it was just closing a parenthesis.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah, another way of putting it is to say that when these goodwill efforts, philanthropy and compassion, all that are at the mental level, they inevitably share the duality and thus the incompleteness and the shadow side of the mental level. And he's talking about what goes beyond that, which is the movement to the psychic being, which has this kind of purity about it, and which can set about purifying the nature. The psychic being doesn't complete the purification, but it's the first stage of integral yoga. So I think what people were saying, it's not like this is bad. It's better than cruelty or something like that. But if you want to go to the complete transformation of human nature, that's something that's never been accomplished before. Even with the saints, their bodies die, it's like, and society goes on. And Sri Aurobindo says we need something a lot more radical than that. And the reaching this inmost being of psychic being is the first stage. It's not, it doesn't even complete it. It's just the first stage of it.
Yeah, I think it's also another point, interesting point. The point is also, first of all, it should not become our primary occupation, in the sense that doing integral yoga is first and foremost about our transformation. But also there is this idea, you know, that by changing laws, by new institutions, by new science and new technologies and this and that, sending the humans to Mars, then we will save humanity or something. That kind of thinking, I think, is a sort of pragmatic, humanitarian pragmatic thinking. He's saying this will not save the world. It can be part of the solution, but it cannot be the real thing. The real thing is an inward transformation of every human being. Yeah? And therefore, doing these things, philanthropy and so on, is fine, it's okay. But remember that, yeah, Jeffrey said it much better than me. You can go back to the to what he said before. But yeah, there is a sort of precedence. Yeah? We should not exchange the order of importance of things, but they cannot coexist. I think that's they. If I'm doing integral yoga, I can be compassionate and benevolent and have goodwill and so on. That was a little doubt that I had.
No. Yeah. Mother said somewhere that if you're not really on the path of integral yoga, it's not a good idea to throw away ethics.
Yeah. Yeah.
And people can get into that saying, you know, I'm a yogi and therefore I have all this freedom, and all these other impulses can then come up and take over, and it's not yoga at all.
Some other question, because I had another question by then. The question for me, the problem is also a bit, where are the limits between what we can say is a psychic impulse and what is still a desire impulse? It's not so easy. I mean, if you say anger, hate, or love and bliss, yeah, okay, that's clear. But there are things in our life, the desire. So then there's a distinction between human love and divine love. So can a couple not love themselves? Otherwise they don't do it in integral yoga. If they marry,
No. The whole point of the integral yoga is that everything, all of life gets integrated.
Yeah.
Into this divine consciousness that we attempt to embody. So nothing is excluded.
Yeah.
That's the whole point.
Well, this thing with the nothing is excluded sometimes makes me a bit so also violence, war, torture, massacring people is also included. I'm a bit, that's should be defined better. I don't know. Perhaps here I'm a bit too mental, but that's was the point. What I was trying to make. Where are the limits between what is psychic and what it is a vital desire, or a vital? He calls it even perversion. He speaks of perversions. Yeah. By the way, what are perversions? Yeah. What kind of perversions is he speaking of? So nowadays we are in this culture where everything is equal. We should be politically correct. Everything, yes and no, because there is a distinction between psychic impulses and vital he speaks also of lower vital impulses. I understand this, but the shade, it is between light and darkness. It's not an on-off choice. There are very many gradations, and it is not clear where to strike and say this is really psychic and this still not. That's I think also a problem for everyone who is doing integral yoga, because sometimes you have some impulses and you say, oh, okay, well, is this divine or is it only me?
It certainly is an issue that I think anybody who undertakes integral yoga or probably any spiritual path experiences. Where's the difference? Earlier on here in synthesis, Sri Aurobindo said that in order to do this path, you have to have an experience of the divine. If you're going to surrender everything to the divine, you have to have an experience of it. Otherwise, what are you surrendering to? You know, some idea.
Yeah. Exactly.
And Mother said the same thing about the psychic being. She says, if you had an experience of the psychic being, you'll know it.
Yeah.
And if you haven't, or if you think you have, then you may not have. But so there's that. So experience. Yoga is about experience and realization. It's not really about thought, about thinking, not about mental distinctions. It's not about distinctions. It's about experience and the realization of experiences. Nonetheless, we have, you know, in our evolution, we have, especially in the West, we have a really strong mental culture. I mean, it's like the mind in the culture at large is practically the only thing there is. And so, sure, we're going to start from there. And there's going to be lots of times when we don't know which it is. So we're, you know, we go through those periods. And, they could last a long time. And we continue seeking and seeking and seeking. And we're looking for first the experience so the experience can guide us. We don't have to use the mind. And then the realization where it becomes settled. And then we have the sure guide that we can recognize. But it's not easy.
And it seems that that is particularly in the heart.
Yeah.
That the realization is in the heart. That the heart is at the heart of the whole thing.
Yeah, well, Sri Aurobindo says there's two ways. He says the inward way, which is the way of the heart. And the upward way, which is the way he took, which is the realizations above. And when Mother came, she brought the psychic being with her as part of the, you know, her contribution to integral yoga. And Sri Aurobindo fully took that on, and he changed his viewpoint about how to guide disciples from the way that he went. And he said the safest way is the inward way to the heart, to the psychic being. But there are these two ways.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Thank you, John Robert. This is a very interesting point. Yeah, because by the way, the word psychic being was originally introduced by Mother. Sri Aurobindo adopted it then and put it in his writings. Yeah. Because that's how I read Sri Aurobindo, is more the intuitive mind, and Mother is more the heart-directed yogini. Yeah,
I think it's really interesting in the Savitri, when the first half of Savitri is Ashapati Yoga, and there's very little mention of the heart until you get to the end of this yoga. And then all of a sudden, there's this repeated mentioning, blossoming of this heart that becomes a real participant in the meeting with the Divine Mother.
Also, to pick up on your comments about society and violence and all those things, of course, anyway, I'm speaking from my own experience, but the reason those things emerge in our midst is when we neglect paying attention to the shadow. If one is present for the shadow part, you know, so the perversions, in a way, what they are is you know, the sides of ourself that have been buried and shut away and that reemerge in distorted forms because of the way they've been constrained and shut up. And that's what comes out as violence and all, you know. I mean, whether it's individually or whether it's collectively, I think that's so. So accepting everything doesn't mean accepting violence. It means accepting the shadow parts of the self in such a way that they don't need to emerge in these distorted forms that become violence and those kinds of things. That's the way I understand it. Anyway, speaking from my own experience, but
yeah, for me, accepting means also becoming aware of the dark, the shadow, this dark side of the shadow, becoming aware and offering it to the divine, offering to something that is knows better than me, and to transform it. But it doesn't mean to give in. For example, typical example, if I have impulses of anger, should I repress anger? No, I don't think it's a good idea to repress anger. But nowadays we have this idea that we should somehow, no. If people speak about it as if we have to let it out. Yeah, but this can be very dangerous. Sometimes I have some very angry idea. I want to kill someone. So I have to some sort of restrain. There must be, because otherwise we can become quite dangerous. On the other side, yes, it's true. Repressing has been shown also not to be the way. So I don't know if I've already lost track of it, but I think it will come up again. But he speaks then about this somehow, that he says we should not neglect it, we should not ignore it, but we should offer it, but not get into it. It's a subtle difference. I don't know if its words are sometimes misleading.
So here I really love this conversation. Here I really feel that, and I have felt this for a very long time, that the big thing that is missing in the integral yoga is the psychology of how to be with your shadow material. I mean, basically, it is all about recognizing it and offering it to the divine, which is a beautiful thing. However, since it's so deep in the unconscious and the subconscious, it behooves us to find ways to become aware, to become fully aware of it, of why it is there, you know, these angers that arise, what, you know, how do I feel diminished that I become so angry or hurt by someone? And there is nothing that I have seen, maybe mistaken, that deals with this in the writings of Madame Sri Aurobindo. And now it's true, I haven't read Sri Aurobindo's letters. There may be stuff in there, but I feel that the psychological awareness that really came in the second half of the 20th century, which was after Sri Aurobindo had already passed, and that there are many techniques that have been developed, right? This is where the therapy is so, ubiquitous right now, because we need to deal with our shadow material and become aware of it in a loving way. And there, you know, the love of the divine can be completely on board to help love the parts inside of us that have been neglected or abused or criticized or diminished in some way, that keep rearing the ugly head when we are unconscious of it. That's just...
Mental is not very good at recognizing the shadow. It's not where... It doesn't come through the mental, the shadow. It comes through the emotional side of our being.
Right, the mental is... Mental.
So the mental, that's why we do this cutting hairs with the mental. We don't do this or do that. What's going on is you're not paying attention to what's going on underneath, because if you were paying attention to it, you'd know whether to do this or do that. it has to do with, so, you know, like you were saying, the anger, you don't necessarily want to express it any old how, but being present for the anger causes it to change. If you're
being present for it.
If you're present for it. But being present for it doesn't mean thinking about it. It means sitting in your body and feeling the anger come through. So it's not always about expressing it. It's about being present for it. Yeah,
exactly. It's not about expressing it. It's about being present. Well,
you can do it in managed ways. I've done sessions where you hit a pillow, stuff like that, to get to express the anger. And
With a pillow, it's okay.
Techniques for managing it, but it's not enough. You have to be present for those. Anyway.
Yeah.
Marco, that's where I think the acceptance comes in.
I accept that
I am angry.
Exactly, yeah.
That doesn't mean that I am going to express it inappropriately.
But that's what nowadays is quite in fashion, that to say that we have to express it. It's not clear what they really mean by that. Yeah, okay, but okay, I agree with you. It's and also with Jeffrey, it's about accept it and to be present to it. Yeah. And in fact, yes, I also agree that Western psychology, especially the modern, more spiritually inclined Western psychology, can help, yes. And especially in our society where we, because I think we must also think about another aspect, that Sri Aurobindo was mainly writing, especially in the letters of yoga, no? He was writing mainly to disciples in the ashram. And the life in an ashram is, in many respects, is different than a life in a busy, especially Western, I think in India nowadays, it's not also pretty much the same, but it's very different kind of psychological set where we live in this modern society where you have a stressed out for your job and you must hurry and you have burnout and this and that. These kind of problems were not so present at the times of Sri Aurobindo, and he was writing to a different kind of public that is nowadays mostly reading now the Synthesis of Yoga. Yes, in letters of yoga, however, you can find more about that. I think here there are more advices how to go into this offering. Yeah? He in fact says first there must be sincerity. If there's no sincerity, don't go nowhere. Secondly, there must be samatha, which means equanimity. So this kind of equanimity, and then this offering to the divine. But it's easy to forget that, especially in our busy life, Western life, yes.
Yeah, and Marco, not to forget, it's interesting you brought up he's talking to people living in the ashram, that they had the mother present.
Yep, yeah.
She was there, and her love was just all pervading, and they could turn to her, and she was there.
And here's the objection of Mother Sri Aurobindo. They would tell you, but I'm always present.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. When you get
I can just hear it. They resonate here. This is a voice in the background. So yeah. But I know, I understand what you mean, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Oh.
Interesting chapter. Essence of the sacrifice. So, what do we do? Do we go ahead? Or
do we reread what we read, or do we go ahead and move forward? I'm not sure I want to reread it, but...
I kind of would like to reread it, because there was so much in it, and now we have had this wonderful conversation. I don't want to reread the whole chapter, that I'm clear about. But what we read today...
Maybe, because it's quite long. And perhaps not all the parts were so, or the part that we read today, the psychic being, I find fascinating, the psychic being. Huh? Because it's not always that clear what it is and what it meant. Yeah. Sri Aurobindo means by that.
I kind of found some of what we were reading today to be, anyway. I mean, I'm interested by the discussion. I think the discussion brought out more things than I saw in the text, but I kind of feel he's repeating himself.
Yeah,
and obviously he's always repeating himself, but you know, it feels like a lot of the discussion here has already been said in other places, and that wasn't really reading much that was really new. A few places, but
psychic being, we already have gone through in the synthesis.
No, I just feel that I don't know the details about this idea or that idea. I just, based on my own readings of the... I mean, I'm willing to reread it, but...
I also... Because I think also it is not repeating, but he sees the same thing from different perspectives. Yeah. So it's, yes, in a certain sense, it's a repetition.
I mean, all this discussion about, you know, not the religious way and not the other way. You know, these are things we've read before, and we've read them, you know. So it felt like re-going over old territory to a great extent. The discussion actually brought out elements that, you know, maybe were not quite so obvious to me on the reading, and that are definitely present in the text, but I don't know. Not exactly annoyed with the text, but I'm slightly not entirely happy with it.
Maybe the next time, if you agree, I can find out for some few letters of yoga who complement these things, because for example the psychic being, and take up some, because there he describes the same thing in a more colloquial way, in a more down to earth, because this is also maybe regarded as a relatively difficult text to understand, whereas in letters he speaks with you as if he's writing a letter to you personally, and he's expressing it as a normal, so to speak, language. I can complement next time with some letters what is coming here, for example, the works of love, the works of life.
I'm wondering if you could share the text from the letters, like if you could take a photo and send us the...
Okay.
So just so that we can, because I think if it's just, I think it'd be more interesting to read it together than just to hear it. So
I can send a PDF. I have the PDF of all the letters.
Okay. That would be good. Just to find a way through it. Yeah. I would be interested.
Right. Mm-hmm. So would you then also indicate which chapters or which letter that you are thinking of? So that, because the PDF would be a huge file.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is thousands and 500 pages. And so, I take an extract.
Yeah.
I can give you also the link of the whole PDF, because you can download it from the Sabda, from the Sri Aurobindo Ashram library. And then I can take the extract and send this also to Peter's. Should I send it on IC, Infinite Conversation? Or no?
Email. Okay. Email, please.
Email everyone, okay.
Please.
I can please put to both. And I was thinking the psychic being, and if perhaps the first paragraphs of what is coming now in chapter 6. I don't know what it is about. Yes, it's works of love, but maybe the first section. Yeah.
Well, we have that, so we don't need to send that. That's in the book.
No, they're the letters. So
there are letters.
The letters that complement eventually them.
Oh, okay.
Because the works of love, about karma yoga, he writes a lot about also that.
Okay, so we'll reread the section that we read today.
Okay.
With the accompanying letter on the psychic being. That the plan?
Oh, you mean for next time?
Yeah, for next time.
And then we're done today.
I'm done.
yeah. If one of us is done, we're done.
Yeah, but it's also nice because we finished the chapter, so we round up. I think this is very mental, but I like it nevertheless.
Yeah, I have another meeting and I need to prepare for it. So
okay. Yeah. Okay.
Beautiful.
So we have a plan.
Let's have a little meditation.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, everyone.
Thank Bye-bye. You. Lovely.
Thanks, all.
Thank you.
Good to see you all.
Yeah. Bye-bye.